everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Just Get Started podcast. I'm your host, Brian Andreyko, and thanks again for being a part of this journey. On today's episode, I welcome in Alex Fink, who is an AI pioneer, Silicon Valley expat, and the founder and CEO of the fastest growing new platform on the internet called The Other Web. Having spent 15 years in various engineering and executive roles in tech, Alex has dedicated himself to solving the biggest problem facing mankind today: digital junk. Junk is everywhere, and we are drowning in it. Other Web is a web and mobile platform that allows its readers to read news and commentary, listen to podcasts, and search the web without paywalls, clickbait, ads, autoplaying videos, affiliate links, or any other junk. He founded his company as a public benefit corporation and has gone from 0 to 4 million active users in less than a year. So we go deep down the rabbit hole of junk on the internet and how we can think differently about the content we consume. So I hope you all enjoy this conversation I had with Alex. And without further ado, please welcome in Alex Fink. Alex, welcome to the podcast. Good to have you.
Thanks so much.
I'm excited for this. You know, I get such a great opportunity to talk with all individuals across the board on this podcast I have over the last 7 years. And it was interesting when you came across kind of my peripheral, I was like, I should know about this stuff, about, you know, kind of how the internet's being created with, you know, the junk we'll get into. But I'm very novice with this. I don't think about it, I guess. So I'm kind of curious to maybe start in the very high level and then let's pull very deep into this. Because this is, if I read correctly, this is your big mission in life. You think this is the largest problem facing mankind. Is that right?
I think so. I think if we are not getting real information into our brains, then it doesn't matter how good our brains are, we're going to make bad decisions.
Yeah.
So if you look around, that's kind of what you're seeing. So I think that's a problem worth fixing.
Yeah. So let's talk about the genesis story. Like why this there's so many problems that, you know, people could say are the biggest problem. Like, why this for you?
I mean, I think there's something personal about this for me. First of all, because of my childhood, because I grew up in the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and I just know what it's like when nobody knows anything and everybody is listening to official propaganda. Mm-hmm. And my parents would listen to Voice of America, and at least they knew something, right? But that was in itself a challenge to get that sort of information. And then I became an information junkie growing up. I would just read everything and listen to everything and remember most of it. And at some point I just started noticing it's getting worse. Like, I don't know why, but I'm consuming the same thing. I'm consuming the same sources, but the information is dumber and dumber and has less and less to do with reality. Mm. And it's taking more and more effort to try and figure out what's actually going on. And so it's been cooking in my mind for over a decade, I guess. And then at some point I just decided, with the help of my wife, who kind of pushed me towards it, to say no to the thing that I was doing for 15 years before that, which was paying good money, yeah, and to focus on this because this is what I really care about.
Well, so let's define kind of some terms as we get into this. So like, because when you say information, so sure, more content's being created like an exponential rate right now. What is, right. Is it the information you said dumbed down? Is it just not detailed? Is it not the best sources? Is it cherry picked data? Is it all the above? Like, what's the, when you say information's kind of dumbed down or maybe not the right information, what do you mean by that?
I think it's not informative. And let me try to define that.
Okay.
Right. Essentially, what you've seen over the past 20 years is a particular selection, almost like evolution, that is operating at the level of memes, information, mm-hmm. right? You have a selective pressure. The way you monetize content is with advertising. Advertising pays per click or per view. So that selective pressure drives evolution. Everything is evolving towards being the kind of content that drives more clicks and views. Hmm. And as you maximize one trait, all the others are kind of left behind because nobody is maximizing them. Nobody's paying per quality or per truth. And what we are seeing is all the other traits are becoming worse. So I guess the correct answer to what you said before is all of the above, right? Yeah. All of these traits are becoming somewhat worse because there is one trait that is becoming better and better. Content is becoming more clickable, more shareable, more viewable, and less everything else. Mm.
Does it come down to then, if I'm kind of reading the tea leaves here, it's we're making content that most people that are putting this out don't necessarily care about the content in the, let's say, article, but it's really getting someone to click on it. So let's say make a really grabbing headline that might, you know, stoke someone's fire, but the information in there is actually not even relevant. It could be there could be a ton of facts that aren't even factual. Is that kind of what you're getting at? It's really just getting the clicks to kind of, you know, for the paid views.
Yeah, I guess the beauty of looking at something as an evolutionary system is the intentions of any particular actor don't really matter.
Okay.
Right. So if a person doesn't care about information quality and only cares about clicks, they'll get lots of clicks. If a person does care about information quality, they will get less clicks and they will succeed less in the system. And so overall, the system itself will still maximize clicks, right? The part of that will be by selecting the kind of creators who create clickable content. And a part of that will be by driving all creators to create more clickable content over time. And so you're seeing both trends, actually. You're seeing organizations that are supposed to really care about quality, right? CNN, let's say. If you go on CNN's website right now and you search their news section, you will find articles with titles like "Stop What You're Doing and Watch This Elephant Play With Bubbles." Now, that is not exactly an informative news article, right? But CNN was driven to this behavior over 20 years of this selective pressure, right? If you go on Forbes, you will find articles ranking protein powders, top 10 best protein powders out there on Forbes. Now, that's not exactly Forbes' calling to rank protein powders, right? But they're driven to this behavior. At the same time, you're seeing organizations like BuzzFeed that had kind of a giant flash in the pan moment because they were the best at driving clicks and didn't even focus on anything else, at least for a while, right? And I think you'll see more and more of that happen over time unless we create some sort of a new incentive here.
So what's that incentive then?
We need paper quality. Now, it's really hard to create. And so what I'm thinking of is punish bad quality will kind of amount to the same thing over time, right? So one of the ideas behind our platform, the other web, was that the bad stuff is filtered out. So now, at least for the people who are consuming content through our platform, they will not get to see bad stuff. Therefore, there is now less incentive for creators to create bad stuff. There's one platform to which it will not go if it doesn't check certain boxes, right? What I would like to see in the long run is not just binary filtering in or out, but more of a scalable incentive that kind of scales with the quality of the content. So the ideal for me would be if ad networks at some point started paying different amounts based on the quality of the content that an ad appeared on. Now, of course, for that, we need to convince all the big guys to play ball. And I don't know if that is their incentive, but at least the big guys are amenable to public pressure, which all those small players in the industry are not.
Well, haven't we seen this, though, change over the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years with especially, you know, the corporate media has had a shift its tune because a lot of these independent outlets, independent journalists, they've gotten a little, just because of the social media, the way that you can share information. I don't know if you've probably seen this as well. It just seems like there's definitely a shift of there's not only a few of the big players anymore, it's more widespread out and the right information's at least being able to be searched and found. Are you seeing that as well?
Well, it certainly exists, right? The more publishers you have, the more likely the truth is to be out there and the harder it is to find. And so I think what's happening is as we went from having 3, 4, 5 networks to having 5 million, now it's impossible to keep a secret. The truth is always out there somewhere, but it's getting drowned by a pile of shit, pardon my French, right?
Yeah, that's true.
We actually had a consultant to a president here in the U.S. who used this very Soviet phrase, flood the zone with shit, when he described how they are drowning a story to make sure that nobody pays attention to it, right? That was Steve Bannon. So that's kind of the problem out there. And right now, when we're looking at how to select news for people to read algorithmically, right, then the problem is not how do we find good stuff. The problem is how do we filter out bad stuff because there is so much stuff out there. So yes, the problem changed when we went from a few publishers to many publishers. By the way, it's not the first time this has happened, right? If you look at the printing press, this is kind of what happened in the 1400s, right? You went from one publisher, the Catholic Church, to hundreds of publishers. And suddenly you have a lot of things that you weren't allowed to say now becoming public, which is a good thing. And a lot of things that didn't really affect people's behavior now affecting people's behavior, like the book that started the witch hunts and caused the death of 80,000 women, right? That also happened. So you have to be kind of careful, understand that there's a tendency when things get democratized for the average quality to go down, and you need new tools to filter it out.
Yeah. And I mean, when you say, I want to make sure too, we kind of talk about this, because this is obviously the controversial thing, is like, what's bad content? Like, whose determination is it that the content is bad? I'm assuming that's a question you get a lot.
It is. And it depends on what the goal is of this person consuming the content as well. Right. So I cannot tell you that elephants blowing bubbles are bad content.
Yeah.
I can tell you it's a bad news article. Right. And there's a difference here, right? It's not necessarily bad content for somebody looking to get entertained, but the telos, the purpose of the news section is to inform you about what happened. And elephant blowing bubbles is not something newsworthy to report there. Right. So that's kind of the caveat you have to take. And even within this kind of definition, you still cannot find one person who can be the arbiter. Just like you cannot find one person that can determine whether a claim is true or not. Determining whether something is true is a social process, right? You have peer review, you have journals, you have editors, you have people trying to disprove each other's work. And at the end of all of that, the truth is whatever bubbles up. And so we need a similar process here. And even though right now we use a specific set of models and we can't just crowdsource everything because there aren't enough people to verify every single claim in every single article, the models themselves are trained on something people did. And so they are essentially the accumulation of the decisions of thousands of people that annotated the content that fed into them. And maybe this emulates the peer review process, but does so at scale. Mm.
So how does that, so let's talk about the other web then. Like, how does it work? If someone goes there, one, maybe let's do what's the difference of, let's say if I go to Google and search, what are the different avenues I'm going to get if I go to the other web? Let's start there and then we'll.
Yeah. So let's start with the fact that right now the main way people interact with it is less like Google search and more like Google News, right? So there's a page, a feed with news articles that you consume. You can decide what section you want to be in right now. We added more fine-tuned options to set your feed so that you can set exactly how many articles you want of every single category. It learns your preferences over time, et cetera. So far, similar to Google, right? Now, here's the main difference. The main difference is we rank all articles across one kind of overarching parameter that we call value rank, but also we create a nutrition label for every article with the outputs of more than 20 different models that all examine something specific, like is the headline clickbait or not? Is there offensive language here or not? Something that is based on some academic work and has been defined well. We also open sourced all these models so people can see exactly what we rank and how, right? And so that allows people to A, control what they see in their feed, and B, even if they see an item in their feed, they don't have to click on it right away. They can look at the nutrition label. They can look at the short bullet point summary and decide, do I want to devote the next 10 minutes of my life to reading a 2,000 word article that might turn out to be crap, right? Or might turn out to be something I don't like. And so we're trying to give people all these tools, and we call it the nutrition label. It's not by accident, right? This is what the nutrition label is supposed to do for you at the store, right? Give you some information about whether you want to consume this item before you consume it. So we try to create as many parallels to that process as possible in our feed. Now, recently we started adding more and more things beyond the news. So there's commentary, there's podcasts in the platform, there's research studies. We recently added a discussion section, which looks a lot like Reddit, and people can discuss news articles on the platform, and we'll add more and more things. So the goal is to try to tackle all information, not just news. But news is the most obvious differentiator, because when you read it anywhere else and then you come read it on the other web, you feel the difference right away, right? I felt it when we just had the first alpha release and I switched from using Google News to using other web. I read it for 10 minutes. I closed my phone because it's a flippy thing, right? And I have this odd feeling of, knowing what happened today and having no emotions about it. Right? I wasn't triggered or outraged or any, I just knew stuff. And I think for people who want this kind of feeling, it's the best platform. For people who want to be outraged, it's the worst one. So it's up to you.
What is the, well, so you mentioned like podcasts. So the is the goal to bring this videos, podcasts, basically to have every type of content or media, I guess you could say, on here, medium on here?
Yeah. Maybe eventually. I wouldn't say that's a high priority because the world of text is pretty large right now. Mm-hmm. And so we added it as an experiment. I don't think actually many people consume podcasts through the platform, so it's not a high priority item at this point. But for the most part, we follow popular demand, right? More people wanted research studies on the platform, so those made it in. Less people wanted podcasts, and so maybe I was the only person using them for a while. Yeah. But in many ways, we have some quirky experiments that me or some other engineer just decided to integrate this and see what happens. We have some things that are added because users asked for them when they replied to our welcome email, or investors asked for them when in our Slack channel where there's more than 2,000 of them, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all driven by what we think people actually want to consume. But the overarching theme is whatever it is, we want to make it higher quality. And this relates also to partisan questions, right? We're not left-wing or right-wing. We have both. But if you're going to consume right-wing content, we want you to consume the best one. If you're going to consume left-wing content, we want you to consume the best one. So you can set the feed in whichever way you like, but we recommend you don't exclude based on left or right. We recommend you exclude based on up versus down.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was going to ask you about these echo chambers, because that's pretty much what the algorithms do. If you're on a social media site, you kind of can just get down the rabbit hole here, and you almost convince yourself that everything you think is true, and you never, you know, kind of get a battled against that. So is there a certain algorithm that's set up then, or how do you, I guess, help people get the content they want, but also at the same time, try not to bias it toward what they continue to consume over the weeks or months?
Yeah, it's a difficult problem, especially for a regular C Corp. And here's why. For the most part, if you look at how the vast majority of platforms set up their recommendation system or their algorithm, they're optimizing for one thing, engagement. They all define it in slightly different ways. Some say a share is more engaging than a click. Some say a click is more engaging than a share. It doesn't matter. They're optimizing for engagement. They're not trying to optimize for the echo chamber. The echo chamber just happens if they optimize for engagement. And it just so happens that the algorithm finds this pattern that when you show people something they already agree with, especially if it says bad stuff about the other side, let's say, it tends to be shared more. Right. And that kind of content tends to rise to the top of people's feeds, and it's different people get different versions of this content. Right. Now, if you're Facebook or TikTok and I come to you, let's say I'm Tristan Harris and I am trying to convince people to do better. Mm-hmm. Right. And I'm coming to Facebook and TikTok and saying you should do less of this and try to show more wholesome content, less controversy, less sensationalism, less partisanship. Let's just help people be better off long term. You can't really do that, right? Facebook can't really follow that recommendation, because if they do, engagement will go down. And if engagement goes down, they show less ads, they make less money. The shareholders sue the executives for breaching their fiduciary duty to shareholders to maximize shareholder value, right? That's kind of the catch-22 that all these companies are in. They have to continue doing what they're doing, unless somebody changes corporate law in Delaware, right? This is why when we registered this company, we registered it as a public benefit corporation to try to avoid this catch-22, because now if we make the choice to, let's say, maximize content quality and try to show people both sides and try to avoid the sensationalistic stuff, yes, we are reducing engagement. Yes, we're probably going to make less money, but we have a legal right to do this because information quality is in our bylaws, right? That's kind of our way around it. Will it work long term? I don't know. It's not a common stance, so I would say it's a good guess, but we might find out that that is not enough and we need to do more to almost bind ourselves to the mission. That's kind of it.
Can you define the public benefit corp? Like, what are some of the high bullet points of that?
So essentially, it's like a C corp that has some mission that benefits mankind in its bylaws, and that mission is binding. So all executives have a fiduciary duty to that mission, and not just to maximizing shareholder value. Right? Both of those coexist. Whereas in a C corp, you're supposed to maximize shareholder value. And you can state a mission for PR purposes, but you're not allowed to prioritize that, right? So if Facebook says connecting the world, great. If there's ever a conflict between connecting the world and maximizing shareholder value, and they choose connecting the world, they get sued. And by they, I mean the executives personally, right? And so they're never able to do that. Public benefit corporation kind of gives the executives a way to say, we can balance those two out, maybe 50-50, maybe 70-30. Up to the exact, but they at least have the right to do that.
I guess if we go into the social media route, like those are such big behemoths. Like, how do you? I guess my concern is always like the information travels so fast. How do you battle that? Is that like, you know, David versus Goliath here? I mean,
well, it's eating the elephant one piece at a time.
I guess.
Right. All the big behemoths started off small, and then they just grew, let's say, at 100% per year for 10 years. And now you're huge, right? So we started off small, and now we're more than 8 million monthly active users, right? So we're growing. That's still not 3 billion like Facebook, right? But at some point, we will begin to make a dent. You can also consider using food as an analogy, right? Because we talk about healthy stuff, so food immediately comes to mind. Whole Foods is only 3.6% of the U.S. grocers market, right? Sounds pretty small, but they're having a huge effect, right? Suddenly Walmart has organic food. Why? Because Whole Foods showed that that sells too. So I think you don't need to be huge to start influencing the entire ecosystem. It could be that as you're growing, you're beginning to make a dent. People are beginning to notice. People are beginning to see that they're leaking users. They're checking where. They see there's this new platform. Okay, what's new about it? Let's copy their features, right? And so I'm sort of welcoming it. We opened our models, right? We want somebody to copy our features, especially somebody larger, because we want the world to become this way. By the time they copy our existing features, we'll come up with new ones that make it even better.
Is there a way to, and I was kind of thinking this, I was prepping, and this might be a bad analogy, but thinking of like plastic, like there's all this junk going into the ocean. We try to pull it out at such a small rate. Is that similar to shit that's on the internet and all this bad content? Is there any way to stop the junk or, I guess, limit it? Or is it just more of a, hey, it's going to be there. It's going to be exponentially greater. We just have to find the right piece of information and the best articles to share and get in front of people.
If you look at this thing systematically, right, then you see that content gets created, it gets distributed, it gets consumed, and it gets monetized. You can try to have an intervention at every one of these four stages, right? So we started with an intervention in the consumption stage because we thought if we show that users care, now we can go to all the other stages as well. It's really hard to go to the advertising networks, let's say that's the monetization stage, and tell them you should care about quality. Why should they if users don't care, right? So we had to start from the consumption side. Same thing, it's really hard to go to content creators and say you have to create higher quality content. Why should they care? It will actually make them less money, right? So the ones who do care will probably just not rise to prominence. The ones that don't care will actually get all the clicks anyway. So we have to affect consumer behavior first, but ultimately, yes, we can affect all four of these stages. And by the way, social media is the distribution engine to some extent, right? So that's also one of the stages. Ultimately, if consumers filter out junk right there in their browser or in the apps that they consume stuff through, Facebook will care, TikTok will care, right? Because what's the point of having somebody look at a link and then hundreds of thousands of people click on it and their browser blocks it? No point from Facebook's perspective, right? So if we can get consumers to block the crap, then ultimately it will start getting blocked everywhere. One of the things that we want to release pretty soon, and we're kind of playing with it already, is a kind of Grammarly-like tool for writers as well. So as people are writing it, they can get feedback on what our models detected about what they wrote. Mm. Like, the headline is clickbait. Too much sensationalism. Why do you have this many adjectives and not enough proper nouns? It seems like you're not informing, you're convincing, etc., right? Give this sort of feedback in real time. But again, people will only care if consumers show they care.
Yeah, you make a good point, because there's a lot of bad actors out there, unfortunately, that are going to just take the short-term win, monetization. They're trying to grow a business or, again, get views or whatever, and they're not thinking long-term, where there's a lot of folks that want to create good content, but I don't know if those are, if that's a smaller minority. And it's just, you know, it's kind of very challenging, I guess, to get past all the folks that just want the clickbait. You know, as you mentioned, that's kind of a big, it's a big behemoth to get over, but it can be one bite at a time. And with your analogy.
Yeah. And honestly, I tend to assume the best about people. So I don't divide the world into bad actors and good actors. There's some percentage of bad actors for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe agents of the GRU in St. Petersburg, definitely bad actors, right? But I think for the most part, people are good, but they're also really good at convincing themselves that whatever benefits them is good.
Yeah.
Right. And so if there's an incentive to create slightly more clickbaity title, now I think more and more people will start doing that. And I actually saw that with, again, people that I followed when they weren't known. Mm-hmm. And as they get larger, suddenly the titles are more and more optimized. Right. And by optimized, I mean destroys in all caps, right? This happened to Breaking Points, for example, which was a nice alternative news source early on. And then at some point it became pretty clickbaity, right? But even like one of my favorite podcasts, Modern Wisdom, Chris Williamson, mm-hmm. right? You look at his titles of the stuff he posts on YouTube, they no longer match what is being said in the clip very often, right? And again, the content is amazing, but somebody's optimizing those titles.
Yeah.
And a good title would reflect exactly what is being said and not try to tease my brain to click on it only to be surprised that the point being made is kind of the opposite of what the title said, right? So that's how it's gradually and insidiously infiltrating everybody, good or bad.
Yeah. Well, you bring a good point, because like I listened to Diary of a CEO with Stephen Bartlett and really love his interview style and the folks he brings on. But to that point, I think they do like, I don't know how, I mean, I don't know the number now, but it's dozens of different headlines and thumbnails like every hour, almost to see which one gets enough views. And that's the one they go with. Again, someone can fact check me on the exact, but I know he's talked about this before. And now with the AI tools, I got to ask you about artificial intelligence. Like, these tools out there make it so easy to get this information out so quickly. And unfortunately, a lot of folks aren't checking to make sure the data is correct or the facts are in there. How do you see AI playing a role in this going forward?
Well, there's going to be a very negative effect in the short term because of a couple of reasons. The biggest one is that AI makes it easier to generate bad, unoriginal content, right? And that content is still going to compete with clicks with everything else. There's just going to be 10 times more of it than any other type of content out there. And so the margins are going to compress for everybody, right? Even for the guys who are creating much better content, they're still competing for roughly the same number of clicks. Mm-hmm. But now there's more competitors out there because now every person who is just churning out those clickbait articles, who is just churning out basically useless content that rehashes what somebody else has said, there's going to be 10 times more of it. That's one insidious effect. The other one, which kind of really closes the vice from the other side, you could say, is that the combination of search and AI, we call it retrieval augmented generation, is allowing an engine to give you an answer to your search query without giving you any links. Like if you ask what are the best restaurants in Portland, it used to be that you would get a bunch of links, one to Yelp, one to something else. Mm-hmm. You click on it, you see the restaurants, you see some ads, right? Somebody monetizes you as a user. But now any kind of search-enabled AI agent would just be able to tell you the answer and link to nothing, which means the number of clicks that goes around is now smaller for everybody as well. So more and more content competing for less and less clicks. Mm-hmm. It's basically a race to the bottom, right? And I think it's going to compress the margins for every content creator, even the really good ones, because competition from the bottom lowers prices. That happens in every market. right? And here the competition is from the bottom and their cost of producing content is zero. And so it's going to be pretty difficult for those who focus on creating stuff. Maybe if you want to survive, you need to start switching towards owning the distribution chain, to speak in sort of economic terms.
Yeah. Is there any way, so you talked about these models that you have and kind of picking up the best articles. Is there any way that you can decipher between something that's written using like ChatGPT versus a human? Is that, I mean, they've gotten so sophisticated, but I think there's got to be some tells, isn't there?
There are some tells, and if you tune a model to recognize those tells, then it will become obsolete in the next version of generative right. models, right? So in the general sense, it's not a solvable problem. Like I can evaluate some quality-based traits, but trying to evaluate who the author is, whether that's a human or a machine, is not a solvable problem in the general sense. There are some companies that are selling solutions that claim to do this right now, but again, it's all heuristics. And it works sometimes, doesn't work in some other times, and it will stop working on whatever the next version comes out. So I'm not even sure that's a problem worth solving to some extent.
Got you.
I think ideally we shouldn't ask, did a human write this or did the machine write this? We should ask, is this valuable, right? And whatever the definition of valuable is, it might depend on what is the purpose of this content, which section of the news site it appeared on, for example. But that is the real question to ask. Yeah, I think with ChatGPT, you should also consider how these things are trained, right? Generally speaking, a large language model just ingests a lot of content that was written by humans. It learns what the patterns are, and it learns to predict the next word as it looks at a piece of text. That's basically what it does. Like a large language model only does one thing, predict the next most likely word. Mm-hmm. So you ask it a question and then the chat element sort of adds answer, colon, and then it starts producing the answer word by word, and it ends up being the most likely text that would have appeared on something like this in its data set. That means the text is going to be very, very human-like, right?
Yeah.
It is just predicting what is the most likely next word if a human were to write this. And so trying to claim that we can tell the difference between text generated by humans and text generated by this model seems, I don't know, very unlikely because it is trained to be as human-like as possible.
So when you think about, so when we started the conversation, it was around, you know, the incentives are you get a click and that's how you're monetizing, getting money. So how is your business set up then if that's not the, if that's the bad, what approach are you taking? Because obviously you guys aren't in business just to do it for free all day. Like there's some business incentive there. So I'm kind of curious how you've structured it to make it where you can hit the incentives you want, but also make sure that you're not kind of capitalizing the way others are from the past.
Yeah. So to be frank, we haven't started monetizing yet. And so maybe I don't have all the answers here, right? Okay. For now, investors are footing the bill and people get everything free and ad-free. Now, at some point, it will have to change. And probably once we pass 10, 15 million, maybe we can try to keep going a little bit longer, but at some point we'll have to monetize. And so the question is, will we just put native ads inside of people's feeds the way everybody else does it? Or maybe we'll do something a bit more wholesome, like let's say advertising only if a person clicked on something and said, I want to search more about this. Right. And then you get you give them a list of results, and one of those results is a paid result or a sponsored one. That's one of the ways that we're going to look at. The other one is regular subscription fees and just say, we have better content. We are not going to dilute it with ads. If you don't want to see ads, here's how much it's going to cost to keep accessing after this date. Those are probably the most likely ways, but unfortunately, I can't think of anything other than ads or subscriptions, or a combination of the two, like on Spotify or Hulu, right? Yeah. There are no magical options outside of these.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess, what do you think of the Wikipedia model and how they go about funding?
Well, it's not less annoying than ads, I can tell you that. I don't know if it's also able to compete, right? One of the reasons Wikipedia was able to win in the encyclopedia market is it was competing with Britannica, right? They weren't competing with Facebook or with Google,
yeah,
or with any of those other behemoths, right? And so, yes, if you're going to beat Britannica, maybe just begging people for donations every time they go into the site is enough. But I don't think it's scalable to something larger than that.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And I think, you know, you made a good point, though, about, because nowadays, I think with subscription models, we're so keen to it, like even with Substack and others, folks are fine paying a few dollars a month or what have you to pay if they're getting better quality content. I mean, individual creators right. are doing this all day, every day, where maybe 20 years ago, it was like, wait, you'd be crazy paying someone like that, because it seemed like the news was quote unquote free. But so I think there's definitely a model there that you could get to if it is better content.
There is, but you need to also be very careful in how you set it up, because one of the problems that I see with monetization through subscriptions in the news business, let's say, is that every newspaper tries to do it. But people don't consume just one newspaper anymore.
Yeah.
And so it becomes extremely annoying if you're using something like Google News and you just click on every interesting link in front of you, half of them want you to subscribe to something that you're not subscribed to anymore. To me as a user, that makes Google News unusable. It certainly makes me hate every single one of these newspapers that right. is throwing that paywall in front of me, right? That's, by the way, one of the reasons why OtherWeb doesn't do websites with paywalls. We just blacklist them, right? Oh. A, because the paywall kind of told us they don't like to share. So why poke the bear, right? But B, because it's a bad user experience for the user, right? If you're going through an aggregator, you never want to see a third party ask you for money, right? You're doing business with this aggregator. So for the aggregator to start collecting a premium subscription fee, it might have to start having deals with all these sites that are being sampled and represented in the system, right? This is what Apple News actually does pretty well. And so we will likely have to learn from them. They're doing some things less well. I think their deals with some of the sources or the publications that they feature are kind of odd and result in an odd user experience. Mm-hmm. Like you ask, don't show me this publication anymore. But I think Apple is not allowed to just remove them from the fees. I don't know why. That's probably what the deal is. So you see a blank page that says this item has been filtered out. Do you still want to see it?
Oh,
which is a really weird user experience, right? But probably they just had to do it for legal reasons.
Oh, wow.
So we'll have a lot of challenges to navigate when we get to that point, because a subscription now means we have to figure out how to distribute it downstream, essentially.
Yeah, I wonder how you square that circle, especially as you have investors, you have folks that are want to see a return on this, and how yeah. like how do those conversations, I'm assuming, starting now? Like, are you going through a lot of those, and just as you mentioned, you haven't got to the point of the user count where it made sense yet. You want to see the model, make sure it works in its current yeah. iteration, I guess.
I mean, those conversations have been happening since day one, right? Essentially, if you're talking to an investor yeah. and they ask you, how much money would you do if you just added ads today? And you tell them a number, and their next question is, well, why aren't you doing it today? That sounds like nice free money you're leaving on the table,
right?
And then you have to explain to them, well, if you look at all the really successful guys, they tried to postpone this moment as long as they could, right? Facebook was 7 million users before they monetized. Snapchat and Instagram were 100, right? In fact, Facebook, after they acquired Instagram, were essentially fighting with the founders of Instagram because the founders of Instagram wanted to turn on monetization, and Facebook told them, no, it's too early for you, right? Mm. Because they knew that you can grow much faster, much larger without this, and then turn it on, right? So those conversations are always happening. It's not an easy thing to do. I'm not even sure that it's an easy thing to design a solution for. You have to iterate, right? Maybe you have to try one type of ad and see, are users pissed off by this?
Mm.
Or is this kind of okay as far as user experience goes? Like, so first you roll it out only to 10,000 users, let's say. You see if any of them complain, if engagement went down, if their the time they spent there went down. Maybe you actually reach out to them and you do a survey and you ask them, like, did you notice this thing? Did it bug you? If they all say yes, then you change it before you roll it out to everybody else. Mm. Because we want you to survive, then we roll it out to everybody else, right? And I think this will be a healthier way to gradually phase it in so that we're doing it in a way that doesn't bother our users or reduce the quality of content they consume.
Mm. Okay. I like that. Yeah. I mean, do you have, like, so if we were talking in 2 years from now, like, and maybe this is stuff you keep in your head a lot and you're kind of just thinking through, but like, what would be success for y'all a couple of years down the road? Is there a, do you go by a user count? Do you go by how the structure of the platform is? What, are there any metrics you use to, I guess, deem success?
I think it's all of the above. I would hope that our user count is, let's say, 10x what it is now. I would hope that our engagement numbers are better than they are now. Like, we are pretty good right now, but we are not world class yet. Mm-hmm. And I want us to be world class. And it's a hard thing to do when you've removed the negative emotions out of stuff, because negative emotions get people engaged, yeah. right? And we're trying to engage people by telling them to eat broccoli and not cake all day, right?
Yeah.
So it's a harder challenge, but I think it's solvable. And we've been improving every month so far. I want us to keep improving in that direction. I also think that 2 years from now, we will definitely have products outside of the consumption side of things, right? Even in the consumption side of things, I see us making pretty controversial things with regards to how people consume content. Like, I don't think that feed and search are the only two ways, but for some reason, those are the only two ways you see everywhere. We have some other ideas we're playing around with, but I want us to have something on the monetization side, on the content creation side. I want us to try to influence people at every stage of the content lifecycle to see, can we nudge them to be better or to do better?
Hmm. And you're not, are you able to share any of those ideas, or are you keeping those close to the vest right now? I'm a curious guy.
I shared the creation side with you. I am unable to share the new ways of consuming content because my PR people would kill me. It's embargoed.
Okay, that's fair enough. All right, I'll have to follow up with you after the fact. Once you put that out there, we could talk another time about it. But it sounds like some exciting stuff. I mean, the fact that, well, I guess maybe we'll wrap up the conversation today with this. Like, you know, for folks listening in that are like, okay, I've never thought about this. Yeah, I know there's issues out there. And most people, I don't think, care, to be honest. I mean, they consume their news how they consume it. They go about their day. They have a million other things going on. What would be your kind of pitch to them of like, hey, this is the reason why the other web, or just in general, better content is important for their lives?
Well, I think you have to consider that what you put into your brain determines how healthy it is, just like what you put into your mouth determines how healthy your body is. And we've all been paying attention to one and not the other, right? I think that it's not that most people don't care. They haven't really thought about what it is that they're consuming all day. And if people just try to pay attention, try to record how long you spend in a day consuming every type of content, and when you're done, try to recall what that was. I think most people can't even remember what they spent the last hour consuming on Instagram or TikTok. If they try to remember, they will be horrified by what they see there, right? So once you do that and you kind of take an inventory of how bad that diet was, now you can sit down and do what everybody who wants to get healthy does, which is try to decide what they want in their diet, right? And it's not going to be the same answer for everybody. Maybe some people want more books. Some people want to talk to their neighbors more. I don't know. But it could be different. But if you just try to plan and try to figure out what it is that I want to spend this much time on Instagram looking at cat videos.
Yeah.
I want to, I'm sorry, is that where people consume cat videos nowadays? I'm behind the times. But I need to ask my wife. She's on Instagram all the time. So if you just plan what it is that you want to consume and how much and where, and you try to at least track it somewhat. You don't have to be super precise, not like counting your calories, but just track it a little bit. Then I think your mental diet will be much better.
Yeah, I agree. I think the conscious thought there, I actually had to delete, I deleted Instagram. I've never been on TikTok, but like deleted Instagram off my phone. Cause I'm just like, it just takes the impulse, I guess. I think the other thing, and we talked about this a little earlier, is like considering the source. Like, don't just take everything like, oh, I read this headline, now this is truth. It's like, hold on a second. Maybe read a little deeper. Who is the source of it? How is it written? Where did, like, the stuff that y'all are trying to figure out. I think that's one thing, too. We look so quick, and then we get this idea like, oh, that's a fact, and we go argue it. And it's like, hold on a second. You just read a headline. How do you know if that's even remotely true? I think we have to be better with ourselves of going deeper on it. If and I know this for myself, is like you can't just take it verbatim right from the top.
We absolutely need to be better, and it's taking more and more effort to do that. It used to be that you just looked at the source, and if it said ABC News, it's true. And if it said, you know, somebody down the hall, then right. It's not true. But unfortunately, the opposite can be true nowadays. Right. So whether you're reading ABC News or the guy down the hall, you need to ask them, what are your references?
Yeah.
Like, where did you see this? Can you show me? Let me look at what language it uses. Double check that the headline even matches the body of the article. It sometimes doesn't,
right?
Or if it's a study, make sure that the abstract matches the body of the article. It sometimes doesn't. And sometimes the headline of the article in the news section in your newspaper doesn't actually match even what the abstract of the study said, right? If it's a journalist writing about science, for example. So yeah, it takes more and more effort nowadays, and we're trying to make it easier.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that, Alex. This is a lot of fun. So otherweb.com is where folks can go check this out. They sign yes. up. They could use the site there.
On the web, you can try it without even signing up.
Oh, okay.
In the app, we do ask people to sign up just so that we can save their preferences, because there's a lot of customization.
Okay, perfect. Wait, do you hang out online at all? Any social media sites? Where can folks say hello to you?
Pretty much LinkedIn.
Okay.
Other than that, if you see me on social media somewhere, it's not me, it's my team.
Oh.
LinkedIn is the only one that's actually me.
Okay, fair enough. Alex, this was a lot of fun, man. I appreciate you coming on. I'm sure I'll have like 30 more questions than I have already dredged up as I'm thinking through this, because this is all new. But I certainly appreciate what you're doing. Seems like good for humanity.
Sounds awesome. And if you have more questions, we can always do a round two.
Awesome. I appreciate that, Alex. Thanks so much, man. Take care.
Thank you.
Hey, everyone. And just one more quick thing before you head off on your day. If you're enjoying this podcast and are looking for other resources and tools to help you get started and move forward toward a happier and more fulfilling life, then I'd encourage you to head over to my website, brianandreco.com, and hit the subscribe button in the upper right corner. There you can find my newsletter and blog subscriptions, where I share insights and information around getting unstuck, perspective, mindset, relationships, habits, and much more. If you get a chance to sign up, I hope you enjoy. Thanks again for listening in. And have a phenomenal day.